So tonight we're going to be talking about church structure, church authority. Let's start with a parable of Jesus, which refers to wine and wineskins. When you think back on the history of our church, we've been through perpetual change. Our church started nearly 50 years ago, and if you were to get into Marty McFly's time machine and went back and looked at our church back then, it would be so different in so many different ways. And when we think about what our church will look like in the next generation, we see that we're going to have to continue to change, as we always have. But there's just one problem with change. People fear change. People abhor change. It frightens them. They like the status quo and they want to stick with it. And so what we need to be very comfortable with is being educated and thoughtful about a theology of church structures which are malleable and flexible and willing to change. When you think through our history, I don't know if you know this, many of the great ideas that turned into new structures and ministries didn't come from the eldership, you know, the top leaders of the church. It actually came from the people or the home church leaders that came up with good ideas. And all of a sudden, they just said, well, we're going to try this, and they tried it, and consequently, it turned into a burgeoning ministry. And so this is something which is incumbent upon all of us to think through how to change things up from time to time. Chuck Smith, the great pastor on the West Coast who passed away last year, he had all these little proverbs that he came up with, one of which was this, "Blessed are the flexible, for they shall not be broken." And really the history of his church, Calvary Chapel, and all of the churches he planted really embodies that pithy statement because they were constantly changing according to the culture without breaking from Scripture. The whole Jesus movement and the hippies coming to Christ, they had to constantly change to keep up with what was happening. At the same time, they were very firm on Scripture and what God taught, and so they're really a good example. Let's think through this passage in Luke chapter 5. We read in verse 30 that the Pharisees and their scribes began grumbling at Jesus' disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with the tax collectors and sinners?" So this would be an example where the Pharisees were rebuking Jesus on something which was actually not a biblical imperative at all. This was some kind of a form or a structure, an extra-biblical idea that you can't even eat and drink, have table fellowship with sinful people like tax collectors and so forth. So they're actually adding on to Scripture here. And Jesus answered and said to them, "It is not those who are well who need a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." So it's in this context that Jesus starts to talk about evangelism. And that kind of sets the proverbial table for what he's going to talk about next. So they come back, they retort, they said to him, "The disciples of John often fast and offer prayers. The disciples of the Pharisees also do the same, but your disciples eat and drink." Now what would this be here? Well, Jesus said to them, "You cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days." Jesus told them a parable, and this is where we really need to zero in. "No one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. Otherwise, he will both tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wine skins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled out, and the skins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins." Well, on the surface, it's easy to understand what he's talking about. What's the literal referent he's referring to? Well, in ancient culture, you would take a leather pouch, and you would put wine into it. And as the wine expanded, it would expand along with a leather wine skin. and that was okay. It would stretch to its absolute stretching point. Jesus' point is, once you drink that wine in the old wine skin, if you fill it with new wine, it's going to have that same effect where it stretches even further, and it's going to burst that wine skin. And so, consequently, we need new wine going into new wine skins. Well, Jesus says, and no one after drinking old wine wishes for new, for he says the old is good enough. So let's try and figure out what he's saying here. We're comparing wine in this parable and old wine and new wineskins and old wineskins. What is the old wine to which Jesus is referring?
The old way of God operating.
The old way of God operating. Not bad. I might call it the old covenant. But you could call it the old way of God operating. What God had commanded in the Bible, in the words, that's the old wine. What's the new wine?
The new covenant.
The new covenant. Brilliant. Yes. The new covenant. This is what God has commanded in the new covenant. He's even referring to the day when the bridegroom will be taken away and then he will mourn. The context is evangelism. And the setting are these extra biblical forms where the Pharisees would say, you can't eat and drink. What about the fasting? What about hanging out with sinners, tax collectors? None of this stuff was from the Bible. It wasn't the wine. So what are the wine skins? What are the wine skins? If the old wine is the old covenant, the new wine is the new covenant, what are the wine skins? The practice is close. Good. The structures, the what I might call the extra-biblical forms. So these aren't things which are actually written of in Scripture. And in fact, many of the things that we do constitute wine skins, not the wine. Why do we meet for a men's group on a Friday night? That's not in the Bible. So you might say, well, you're breaking from the Bible. No, it's just the Bible doesn't say anything about it. It says to meet together, the one another passages. That's the wine. The wine skins are, where are we going to meet? When are we going to meet? What are we going to do? And what does a meeting look like? And many of these things are extra biblical forms. And so many people could look at that and say, well, you're breaking from Scripture. No. The whole point here is that we want to stick to the teaching of Scripture, which is universal, but we want to have extra biblical forms or structures that can capture the wine. Let me give you some examples. The leadership training class was something that we added, I believe, back in 2008 or 2007. Dennis McCallum was teaching a college CT and an adult CT. And one of the adult CTs went away. They recombined it with some others. And so the question became, what are you going to do with those hours? So he and the elders decided, why don't we start to do a leadership training class? And so he trained the other sphere leaders, and they took off their own classes. And we saw, at that moment, 2007, we were at an all-time low. And about a year and a half later, we had all these LTC graduates, had been through all the training. That's when we started to see a huge revival. I would say that was a good wine skin to add. Epic. This camp that we send high school students to, we had a vacation for our college students, which we found to be really powerful and exciting for people. A week away with believers, hearing the word taught, we thought, man, if only we could do that for high schoolers. And then we did, and that's been hugely successful. Spheres, the idea that you have certain spheres and sphere leaders, that instead of having the elders loosely looking over and overseeing the entire church and really breaking it up into student ministry and adult ministry, and then having a bunch of coaches work for the elders, the elders decided that we would actually have sphere leaders so that you'd have closer contact to pastoral oversight and breaking up the church that way. Reading with your disciple. 50 years ago, 40 years ago, people didn't do this. They read. They did read, but they read on their own. And so if you met with your guy, you met with your girl, you would say, all right, we're going to read through Watchman Nee, Sit, Walk, Stand. Why don't you read the first chapter? I'll read the first chapter. Then we'll meet and we'll compare what we read, what we highlighted. Dennis and Gary, they were trained on the West Coast under a PhD student, and that's how he trained them. He gave one book to Dennis, a survey of the Old Testament by Gleason Archer. He gave another book to Gary, K.A. Kitchen, Old Testament, not Old Testament Against the Environment, the other one, Ancient Orient and Old Testament. And then, after that, they would switch books, and then they would come back and compare what they read and so forth. So that was the paradigm, is that people would just read on their own, and then when they'd show up for a time of discipleship, they'd already read. We hit a certain point in the 90s where people stopped reading. So you'd show up to your time and be like, so what do you think of that chapter? And the person would be like, I didn't read it. Next week, I didn't read it. Third week, I didn't read it. Consequently, it became a wineskin that you just sat there and read with the person. And you'd read through it and make observations to know, and actually in many cases to teach people how to read. Many of the schools people went to never taught them how to read, didn't teach them. And so this has been a way to actually educate people. Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. One of the things that we ran into in our fellowship is that people were a very academic fellowship, and so people wanted to continue in education, get their master's, maybe get a PhD. And so as a result, they would, you know, start to develop a personal ministry, and then they would go away for 2, 3, 4 years to get a graduate degree in theology or, you know, an MDiv or something like that, or a PhD, whatever. And we found that this was kind of a bottleneck where people would leave, and then they would come back, and then we discovered it just wasn't healthy for the person to go away to seminary and basically just be in academia for multiple years, not doing ministry, not working with people. It's really a bizarre concept, which many seminaries are moving away from, because they've realized that New Testament Christianity shouldn't be that you go away and you get educated like a doctor and you stop doing ministry for several years. But instead, you should kind of grow where you're planted. And so many different seminaries, some of the best, have planted extension sites all over the country so that you could go and get some education, but you could still serve at your church. And so we brought this in, and this was a huge hit, because people that wanted to get a degree, they could get that, and they could get it from one of the finest graduate programs in the country. The Home Oasis Program, HOP. We do Oasis, which is childcare for Central Teachings. Somebody came up with the idea that maybe we could actually do this for home groups, where we could actually pay people to run a Bible study and to watch the kids while the adults have their meeting. And so in many of these HOP home churches, you have the adults sitting upstairs. They do their teaching with each other. Here's time where they can actually be around peers and be away from the kids for an hour and a half or 2 hours. And then in the basement, in some of these groups, you have more kids than adults. And so it's kind of like trying to hem in stray cats, you know, with this many kids down there. But they sit them down, they teach them a little Bible study, and they play games with them and watch them so parents can have fellowship with each other. And this has been a huge hit. These groups that qualify for it love it. And we also get to employ a lot of our college people, and they're paying pretty good money for this because it's very effective. The Discipleship Cafe, this was an idea where a lot of these young mothers, they don't have time to read the Bible, to pray. They're constantly with their kid nonstop. Of course, husbands, babysitters should be the first ones to step in to help out. Absolutely. But we also offered the Discipleship Cafe, where we provide volunteers to watch kids for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, twice a week. So if you had somebody you wanted to meet with, you could do it during that time and there'd be childcare. And so you come to the Discipleship Cafe and you see all these young mothers either getting their sanity back by getting into the Word and prayer, or they're meeting with, you know, a girl or two, and this has given them an opportunity to still thrive in these years, which are really difficult. So those would be some examples of adding. Now, are any of these things written about in the Bible? Are these new covenant imperatives. You must have a HOP program for your house churches. You must have a seminary that's in your city. No, none of that is in the Bible. What we found is that these are wine skins that help keep the wine so that the wine doesn't spill. Well, examples of cutting, things that we've cut over the last 40 years. Singing. We used to have, there was literature. I mean, it was written on typewriter of what you would do in each individual home church. They had a singing leader and how to get the group together to sing. I've seen this doc. It's a real document. It's with my own eyes. I saw it. And how to sing and what songs you can do and how to get the group, how to lead the group into singing. And that was common at the home churches. We cut that because it started to become strange to people who were checking out house churches for people to be singing, and it just wasn't conducive. We used to pass the plate, the collection plate, on campus. Now at adult CTs, we still do this. Why? Because I believe it brings in about $100,000 a year from people just putting money in the plate as it goes by. So that's something. It's also more common for adults that when they go to church, they pass the plate. So it's a structure that's not foreign to them. On campus, it was totally bizarre. You'd be at a campus Bible study, all college students, and the plate would go by. It made people feel uncomfortable. We would, at the end of the night, they would see $3 and a pack of cigarettes and a coupon to Burger King in the plate. It was just like, okay, this needs to be cut. It's not working. Closing the school. We have a school. We have two schools, Christian schools, one of which we closed because there just wasn't a demand. We didn't have enough students to fill the school, and so the school was taking a profit hit on the order of tens of thousands of dollars per year. And we actually closed the school and doubled it up, the remaining people, into the other school. At the time, this was not received well, you can imagine, because we had teachers at that school. We had people employed at that school. And so this was a difficulty. On the other hand, we don't want to waste people's giving, their hard-earned giving, on a school when we feel like we don't need it. And so this was cut. We might end up bringing it back because we have all these young people who keep breeding and they're producing kids, and all of a sudden we're going to have all these young little babies and coming up into kindergarten, one of which is mine. He just started kindergarten this year. And so we're probably going to have to bring this back. But that's an example of a wineskin. We moved to biweekly home churches right around 2006. The idea was that if in adult groups, if you went from weekly home church to biweekly, that this would give you more opportunities to get out into the city and make friendships and share your faith and build relationships with people that don't know Christ. The result that this had was actually the opposite. We found that our value of fellowship and the one another passages means so much that if you miss a home church meeting biweekly, that means you miss a month of fellowship. And so people weren't excited about the relationships in the group. They weren't enjoying them. They weren't close. We heard examples where somebody said, yes, my friend wants to come out to hear the Bible taught. And they said, well, we're a biweekly group, and that week we're not doing a teaching. We're hearing enough of that, and then we started doing statistical analysis on how are the weekly groups doing versus the biweekly. And far and away, the weekly groups were doing way better. And so we cut this. I don't think we have hardly any biweekly groups anymore. Potential examples, as you think into the future, what could we cut? What could we add? Some people have suggested cutting PowerPoint. It's a fair question to raise. They didn't use it in the early church. It could be argued that when you don't have a visual, but you just have a speaker, that you're more engaged with the person, that you're looking at them the whole time. Instead of looking up at a screen, like our screen culture, everything is just zoned out in front of the screen. That if we got rid of PowerPoint, maybe you would be more connected to the person. Debatable. Should we use email? A lot of people are saying, well, this is going by, and we have to replace it with the GroupMe or the Facebook groups or Slack is one of them. And, or email. Do we want to be dinosaurs and stick to email? We recently debated this on our leadership team. Do we want to do away with email? Move to something else. Email prevailed in that debate. We thought email was good because you can actually have a thoughtful response that when you're discussing things, you can take your time. And there's something about just getting instant, feedback and messages. It's not substantive. There's not much substance. And it's just very quick. And we wanted a venue where you could have thoughtful dialogue. And email seemed pretty good. On the other hand, when email was first being used, people were opposed to it because they said, we'd rather talk face to face. On the other hand, when the telephone was invented, I'm sure they said the same thing. That, yeah, we'd rather talk face-to-face rather than over the phone. Now, talking on the phone is like deeply intimate and personal. So, I don't know. Should we use PowerPoint? That's not in the Bible. Should we use email? That's not in the Bible. Should we use toothbrushes? That's not in the Bible either. That was my one joke for the whole night, and everyone just stared at me. The whole point is, just because it's not mentioned in the Bible, that doesn't mean we should get rid of it. These are wineskins. We got to see, are they useful? And we have to be willing to change our wineskins. What we're trying to get at here is this question. Is the wine spilling? That's Jesus' point. You don't take an old wineskin and fill it with new wine. If you have an old structure that was meant for the old covenant, you don't take that and try and put new covenant teaching into it. Why? Because it bursts. That's why. And it spills the wine everywhere. No, you don't try and patch it with a little bit of old covenant structure or something like that. No, we need to come up with new wineskins, and our criterion for judging whether this is a good wineskin is this. Is the wine spilling? Is this getting the job done? If it isn't, we got to come up with some new wineskins. People who are loyal to wineskins, even though they're failing, this is tantamount to idolatry. That we're worshiping the forms, we're worshiping the ideas. We could see this in other churches where, you know, the music is on the cutting edge of 1796, and even the instruments are the same way. And it's like, why was music just stuck in that period of time and we haven't moved forward? Because there were a number of congregants who said, we don't want to move past the organ. The organ is good. The organ is great. That's how we've always done music, and we're sticking with the organ. In some churches, when they brought in acoustic guitars, this was thought of as just completely heretical and crazy that you would do that. Incidentally, Calvary Chapel, for better or for worse, was responsible for contemporary Christian music. Then maybe you don't like contemporary Christian music. You probably wouldn't have liked the stuff that came before. Much better. Calvary Chapel started with music that the hippies would sing, the hippies were into. And they took a lot of flack for that. At the same time, they were trying to change to accommodate the culture. And the same thing could be true in our church, where people are just so accustomed, this is the way we do things, to say that we're going to change. They get real frantic about that. So to put this a different way, in half a century, I'll probably be gone by then, but hopefully our church isn't gone, unless Jesus takes us. But in 50 years, we should have totally new wineskins. Not in every area. I mean, there's some wineskins we have from 50 years ago that we still believe in now more than ever. The point is we should have new ones. These should be constantly getting invented. But at the same time, we shouldn't change our wineskins simply for the sake of change. That is a huge mistake, where people are constantly deconstructing and ripping apart wineskins that have proven to work. Like people say, we got this idea, we're going to cancel our men's group. Why? What are you going to do instead? Well, we're just going to go out and try and meet people on campus and stuff. Okay, your men's group is actually working. You're equipping them. You're building them up and ripping these apart. And what are you replacing it with? We want to keep the ones that are working, and we don't want to give up on these real quickly. But we should be willing to change. So do you see the tension? How does this all work? How would you know if we should change a wineskin? Well, we go through a process. At first, where we must begin is with the New Testament precepts and principles. Precepts and principles. Let me give you a counterexample. One church, one of the biggest mega churches in the United States, when they planted their church, they didn't start with the New Testament teaching or principles of what the church is or what the church should do. Instead, what they did is they went to the greater metropolitan area in which their church was planted, and they went through and they canvassed through interviews, what would you like to see in a church? What would you like the topics of study to be about? How would you like to see a church run? What are the things you hate about church the most? And they basically did an interview process and collected all of that data, and the data showed certain features, and that's how they started the foundation of their church. In my estimation, that is a huge mistake. We don't start with what does the culture want. We start with what does God want? What does the Bible teach? And that's our foundation before we start looking to the culture. We'll get there, but just not yet. What do I mean by New Testament precepts and principles? Precepts are universally binding imperatives. Universally binding imperatives. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. But you say, well, those are moral precepts. Okay, go and make disciples of all nations. That would fit with our precepts for what the church is and should do. The 54 one another passages, those are precepts. Those don't have to do with the first century. Those are imperatives for all times, all places. So precepts are binding imperatives for what the church should do. On the other extreme, you have examples which are just what happened. Paul did blank. Peter did blank. The church did blank. They're just examples without commentary. It's just what happened. And since we're thinking about ecclesiology, the study of the church, we're going to focus on the book of Acts or the epistles or Revelation 1 through 3 or the few statements from Jesus. They're just examples of what the church did, but that's not necessarily what we should do. Then in the middle, you have what's very fuzzy, very blurry, but we're going to give some, I was about to say principles, we're going to give you some ideas on how to discern principles. This is how I'm going to define a principle. A principle is either a softened imperative or a strengthened example. A softened imperative or a strengthened example. So, in this case, if you have a precept, it's an imperative, it's saying do such and such, there could be cases where you could argue, well, that was just for that culture. And you'd say, yeah, but it's an imperative. So what's your basis for saying it was just for that culture? Well, the burden of proof would be on you to say, well, that's not supposed to be to the letter. We don't want the law of the letter. We want the spirit of the letter. What is the principle behind that imperative? Now, we can't just do this pell-mell. Like if I just say, well, I just think that was cultural and the principle behind it is such and such. What we need to do is say, I've got the burden of proof. I got to show why I think there's a principle behind that, but the letter of the law is not the case. So that's why I say a softened imperative. You might say you're looking for the principle behind the imperative. Examples which are strengthened, what you need here is an example or multiple examples mixed with an imperative. So if you had example after example after example, that would be pretty strong, but then you need an imperative to show that's what we should do. Or you would need some other kind of theology to strengthen these examples. I know this is very abstract. Let me give you a few examples. 1 Corinthians 16:20, greet one another with a holy kiss. Would that be, okay, there's a principle here. Would that be a softened precept or a strengthened example? Softened precept. It's an imperative. Greet. If I said you go out there and greet one another with the holy kiss. Now, this is an imperative. Go greet one another with the holy kiss. Now, why is it that I don't let anyone holy kiss my wife? Because they know I would holy punch them in the face, right? Why don't we do this? You'd say, well, you're breaking from the Bible. We're saying in that culture at that time, that's how you would greet another person. You'd greet him with a kiss on the cheek. In our culture in the United States, that would be viewed, well, that would have a lot more connotations. We're a highly sexualized culture, and at the same time, we're a highly frigid culture where we don't like to even touch each other or be near each other. So to see somebody cross the boundary and go up and give a woman a kiss on the cheek, for many people, that would send the wrong message. But what's the principle behind this? I'm not going to go up and kiss you on the cheek, but what's the principle behind this? Be warm, be friendly. This could be the holy handshake, the holy hug, the holy high five, the holy how are you doing? I don't know. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't have to be a kiss, but you have to be warm and affectionate to each other. Good. So this would be a culturally bound precept or a softened precept. What about this one? Acts 9:25. Paul's disciples took him by night and led him down through an opening in the wall. And I'm quoting this and I'm saying, this supports discipleship. Is this a softened precept or a strengthened example? Strengthened example. It's not telling us what to do. It's not saying that you should make disciples. It's just an example. It doesn't really give us any commentary. But how do we know that this is supportive of discipleship? After all, it's just an example. Because we have imperatives which say, go, therefore, and make disciples. Or 2 Timothy 2:2. Entrust these words to faithful men, we'll be able to teach others. So we have imperatives which say, go make disciples, and then we come across a passage that says that Paul had disciples. How about that? All right, what about this one? Acts 17:2. According to Paul's custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. And I'm saying that one of the things we should have in the church is apologetics based on Acts 17:2. Paul used reason, we should too. Which one is this? Softened precept or strengthened example? Strengthened example, very good. You might argue that because of that initial clause, according to Paul's custom, that strengthens it even further. This wasn't something that Paul just randomly did. It's something that he always would do. That was his custom, was to use apologetics. Now, how do we know that this isn't just a naked example, that we're just appealing to that? Well, we have imperatives that support using reason. 1 Peter 3:15, 2 Corinthians 10:3 through 5, etc. All right, what about this one? 1 Corinthians 11:5. Every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head. If a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. Softened precept. True, you could also view this as an example, because verse 5, he's just talking about what's happening in the church. In verse 6, he actually says, let her have her hair cut off. That seems like a precept to me. What's the principle behind this passage? Some people would take this literalistically and say that women need to have their hair covered. What's the principle behind 1 Corinthians 11? Do you know? Yeah.
It's so that you don't
have... Yeah, in the culture, Greco-Roman culture or Jewish culture in the ancient world, at this time, to have a woman with her hair down was deeply distracting. It would offend the culture, and it would send the wrong message. Incidentally, by having churches where women have their hair covered is against our culture, alienates people, and is deeply offensive. So they followed the letter of the law, but they have not followed the spirit of the letter. They followed what the precept is saying. At the same time, they haven't followed the principle behind it. Paul would be pulling out whatever hair he had left if he saw this today. The principle is don't offend your culture. Good. So let's give some examples of precepts for ecclesiology, the structure and function of the church. Qualifications for elders. These would be precepts. 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1. These are non-negotiable. Rules for the use of tongues. 1 Corinthians 14. Paul's very explicit. One at a time, there must be a translator. No more than that. I mean, he goes through and gives a list of rules. You can't go beyond that. Those are precepts. The one and other passages, 54 of them. These are not culturally conditioned. These are for all places at all times. Universal, binding imperatives. The Great Commission, Matthew 28. No, that was not just for the original disciples, as the reformers argued. Jesus said, "Lo, I will be with you always, even to the end of the age." And so this is something that we make disciples and they make disciples until Jesus comes back. Church discipline. We see a litany of passages about church discipline, formal church discipline. And this is not something that we can just say, well, we just don't do that here. No, that's something that is a universally binding imperative. Every member ministry, where every single person is equipped to do the works of service. Ephesians 4:12. These are precepts. So to go back to that earlier example I gave, where we go out and we canvass the city and we ask, what would you like in a church? They might not come up with this list. In fact, there's a good chance they wouldn't come up with half of the things on this list. We have to start with what God says the church is and what it's supposed to do. Principles that we could derive would be things like this. Plurality of elders. Plurality of elders. How do you know that? How do you know it's a principle? Well, we see, for example, in Titus chapter 1, Paul says that he appointed elders in every city, singular. Plural elders, singular city. We see as we go through the New Testament that it's always plural elders, never one elder in a church, always plural. So those are examples. In 1 Peter 5:2, it could be an example. It could be a precept. Peter says, shepherd the flock of God among you, plural. He says, I speak to you as a fellow elder. Shepherd the flock, singular, not flocks. Shepherd the flock, one flock, singular, among you, you guys, y'all. So, plural elders, singular flock. I could be considered an example, but it is in the form of an imperative. Also, we could add to this, remember I said you could have multiple examples, but then you'd have to add some kind of theology which is well taught. What theology is well taught that would make us want to have a plurality of elders? Sin. The theology of sin, hamartiology. That we don't trust having one person in power to make decisions. That there needs to be a check working in a group, that we wouldn't have someone who's a tyrant, but that we would have multiple people working together on a team. That seems like a good reason for having plurality. Large and small meetings. This is a principle. This isn't explicitly taught. The Bible nowhere says you should have home churches. It doesn't say it. It gives multiple examples of it. To the church in her house. To the church in his house, to the church in her house, the church in his, the church in this house, in that house. Apparently that's what they did back then. And we also have examples of large meetings. Acts chapter 2, Acts chapter 4, where they met in the portico of the temple. And apparently the apostles would just preach openly. Then we get to Acts chapter 19, where Paul rented out the schoolhouse of Tyrannus, who was a philosopher. And that was a large meeting. Apparently people would come, it said that people from all over Asia Minor would come and hear Paul teach. And so there's examples of large and small meetings. How would we get a principle out of this? Well, for one, we see it in multiple different contexts. We see it in Rome, house churches. We see it in Corinth. We see it in the early church, Acts 2:46. They met daily and from house to house. So no matter the culture, they had house churches. We also could make an inference from the one and other passages. It doesn't need to be a house church, but there needs to be some kind of a smaller meeting where we can exercise our gifts. We can't exercise our gifts in a room of 500 people. That's not plausible. So part of this is reason. Part of it is looking at the context and the situation of the examples. And then part of it is large meetings. We see that in different contexts as well, in Jerusalem and also in Ephesus. And that it just makes a certain amount of sense that if you had a guy like Paul coming to your city, it'd be nice to have a large meeting where you could hear somebody like Paul teach, that you wouldn't restrict him to an individual house church, but you could get him out in front of hundreds of people. The holy kiss, the principle is being warm, being hospitable, being kind, affectionate. The communal money in Jerusalem, Acts 2:44, it says they shared all things in common. It's an example. There's other times, like in Acts chapter 5, where Peter says to Ananias, didn't the money belong to you before you sold it, or the property? Didn't it belong to you? So there's personal ownership. What's the example or the principle behind communal money? It's generosity. It's that people were seeing that there's poverty and we need to meet people's needs. Putting the money that they collected at the feet of the apostles. What principle could we get from that? Well, we don't have apostles today, but we do have elders. And if we're supposed to collect money, which is a biblical imperative, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8 through 9, we're supposed to collect money. Who should handle the money? Well, in the early church, they gave it to the apostles. They trusted them with it, or faithful men, 2 Corinthians 8. So we could get a principle from this that in the church, the people who should handle the money, first of all, it should be a plurality that we're checking each other. And it should also be the spiritual leaders of the church. If we can't trust them with the money, who can we trust? So, hopefully that wasn't too confusing. And there is debate here. I hope you're picking up on that. When would that go from an example to a principle? Or how do we know that's not just a universal, literal imperative? How do we know that that's supposed to be principalized? Well, first, we come up with answers on this. The principles and precepts. Then we study the cultural trends. So we go out, and that's when we would do our canvassing. What's the culture like? We read studies. We meet people. We try and figure out what is our culture at? Where are they at? What would they be into? Now, we don't want to break from biblical imperatives, biblical teaching. That's not what we're saying. We're saying we want to be all things to all men. So how can we set up a church in such a way we're not betraying God's will, but we're also being constantly in tune and sensitive to culture? Once we figure out certain cultural issues, then we start to create wineskins, ideas, structures. So, for example, let me give you an example. College-age students, would they ever come to a Bible study, like a central teaching, on a Sunday morning? No. The people that we're befriending and reaching out to, these people are hungover Sunday morning, or they're working Sunday morning because that's their only time to work. Last thing they would want to do is get up and go to church on a Sunday morning. So we create a new wineskin. We pick the most boring night of the week, Monday, and we make it at night where no one's doing anything on college campuses. Now, what if you went into the adult ministry? Would you have a meeting on a Monday night at 8:15 p.m.? No, because adults are staying up not as late as college students are staying up till midnight or 1. Adults are in bed by 10 p.m. because they're getting up to go to work. Plus, they have kids, so they wouldn't be into that. So why would we do that? Meanwhile, in our culture, everybody has Sunday off. Adults are on a clock where they're used to getting up at 6 a.m. for work, and now you're saying, why don't you come out to a Bible study at 9 a.m.? They're like, yeah, that's sleeping in for them. So wineskins would change depending on the culture. So we start with the New Testament principles and precepts. We think about the culture. What would be fitting for the culture? We create wineskins based on this. And then we evaluate the results at the end. And we're seeing, is this spilling the wine? Like if somebody had the idea of, well, we should do a college central teaching on a Sunday morning. Let's say we went with that. After a year, we would go through and evaluate the results and we would say, no, that's a terrible idea. We're cutting it. We're going to do something else. And then once you evaluate the results, you go back and you start the process all over again. We do, at the very least, an annual assessment of our wineskins. So maybe you've heard that we have a planning and budget retreat. That's where we get all the elders and the sphere leaders and the division coordinators. We take them away for 3 days. We work from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's a work trip. And we go through, everyone gives a presentation on their sphere, their division, whatever. And we go through and we look at what's working, what isn't. And we stare the facts in the face. That's our planning retreat. Then we come back for a budget retreat and we decide what needs to be cut. They call this killing the sacred cow. In India, they view cows as sacred animals, and so you would never kill a cow, even to feed people. We look at that and we say, wow, that's really inhumane, because here we have all these people starving to death, but your religious system says the cows are sacred, so we can't kill the cow to feed people. The same thing is true in the church. We could be wasting people's money that they've worked hard to earn and given in good faith because we can't kill the sacred cow. We've got this Christmas pageant which doesn't do anything and it's lame and nobody likes it. And so, but we keep spending money on it. We need to kill the sacred cow. All those things we mentioned before, things that we've cut. Well, this is at least annual, I said. In many cases, we're shifting these up throughout the year, where we're trying to change wineskins, change approaches, and at least once a year, we're coming back in saying that needs to be cut.